Yeah. Put that on your outtakes reel at the end.
Oh, God.
Okay, so Elliot, imagine you're just walking down the street and it's a summer day and the, okay, sorry, I'll drop all the goofy analogies to kick off podcast.
I was going
to
say, is this another picnic table?
I was waiting for you to jump in and say, no more of these dumb intros, Merrick.
First of all, let me just say, before we get to Merrick's tortured ideas here, hope all the mothers on this podcast had a great Mother's Day. To Claire, to Joe, who is almost partner, and to Steph, of course, who was my long-suffering wife. So that's number one. Number two, I have to say this. So if you listen to Friday's podcast with Jeff's tortured allegory of someone leaving their wallet and keys on a picnic table and comparing it to Tom Wilson.
Just because you didn't understand it doesn't make it not good.
I understood it. It was stupid. I happened to be watching some kid show with my son, Max, the other day, and there's a guy who leaves his lunch on a picnic table and goes to look at something in the forest, and his lunch gets stolen.
That's awesome. I love this
story.
And
I'm thinking to myself, I cannot believe on all days I see this. It's the same day as Jeff's tortured analogy. Unbelievable.
It's brilliant. And that's the universe reminding you how smart it was. Do you not, you know, understand what that was, Elliot? That was the universe saying, hey, you need to pay attention to what Jeff is saying. Like, there's a lesson in there the universe was trying to teach you. Whether you choose to receive it or not, I suppose, is your own business. But that was the universe tapping you on the shoulder. The least you could do is turn around and say, am I supposed to learn something here?
It's like matter, antimatter. There's no energy created. It's all one way or the other. It's the law of what? Conservation of mass?
Yes.
So you came up with a stupid idea and YouTube, my son was watching, came up with a good one. All right, let's go. Lots of coaching stuff to talk about.
As I've told you before, Elliot, I'd agree with you if you were right. Now, coming up on the podcast today, we're going to talk to Kirk Muller. And appropriately enough, we are talking to a coach on a day where this podcast is going to revolve a lot around coaches, and we'll talk about coach signings. We'll talk about coaches parting ways with their teams. As we record this on Sunday afternoon, two coaches are no longer with their NHL clubs. The hunt is on for replacements, and the hunt is on for both of them to find new places of employment. We'll start with the Columbus Blue Jackets. And after six seasons, there is a parting of the ways between John Tortorella and the CBJs, as they're called. I don't want to say that this was predictable, but many looked at this season, how it was going, the lack of contract extension after this season, and said, this is probably just going to resolve itself at the end of the season with John Tortorella no longer being around Nationwide Arena. What happened here?
I think you said it right. It was predictable. Even if you don't want to use the exact word or phrase, it was predictable. I think we all knew this was coming. I don't think that anyone needed to say, hey, we need to fire you. I don't think there needed to be any kind of long conversation. Everybody knew what was going on here, what was coming down here. And I really liked that in his last game, for example, he pulled the video coach out of his, you know, regular viewing area and said, why don't you come and change the defense pairs for a period? I thought that was a really nice thing to do. The key thing here, I wondered, Tortorella will be 63 in June. Does he want a coach or is he retiring? And I think the answer is bleep no, I want a coach. I think he does want a coach. I think he's going to make that very clear. Mm-hmm. To me, one of the most interesting conversations that's going to come out of this year is, already the reports are out, and I believe they're true, Arizona is going to try to go young. So a coach like Tortorella, who's in his age range, we interviewed Bob Hartley last week. He's 60. You know, Tortorella will be 63. I don't know if ageist is the right word. I don't know if this is ageism, because I'm not sure it's actual specific anti-age prejudice, or it's simply a conversation about, do you need younger people to relate to younger players? But I do think that especially the rebuilding teams are going to look at younger coaches. The other thing, too, I'm really curious about here is going to be salary. You know, we've talked about this. There's a big conversation being held about how much coaches and executives make. Rod Brind'Amour has an extension on the table that we believe is verbally agreed to. It's a 3-year extension at $1.8 million per season. It is well below market value. He could do at least double that if he wanted to on the open market. He doesn't want to leave Carolina, and the Hurricanes know that. Now, what's going to happen here is you're going to see some teams say, well, hey, Brind'Amour makes this, so how can you get more than him? While, you know, people are going to say, look, like, his situation is unique. He's not leaving there. He's not using his leverage. However, I think for a lot of coaches here, there's going to be a conversation about, are you willing to work for less than you've worked before? I think some teams are going to squeeze it tight. And I think a lot of these coaches who've been used to the $2 to $3 million salaries, they're going to have to look at it and say, okay, how do we feel about that?
The way that I look at Brind'Amour and coming in under market, I think we've talked about this before. When you look at your career, do you look at it year to year, or do you look at the entirety of it? Like, do you look at it and do you say, you know, only a couple of years out, this is how much money I want to make? Or do you say, here's how much I want to make in 20 years? Because if I'm Rod Brind'Amour, where it might look like a haircut and feel like a haircut or coming in under market value, which he is, I look at the Brind'Amour situation and I say, he's coaching a really good young team. And it's a team that's going to be good for a lot of years and can probably be really successful and probably win at least one Stanley Cup. And then once you have that on your resume, all of a sudden, your ticket changes. So look at Brind'Amour's situation. I say, this is an example of a guy, at least to me, Elliot, who's trying to play the long game here. Mm-hmm. And if you're playing the long game, you want to be on a winner. Because once you're involved with a winning organization, once you're a winning coach, you're a winning coach when it comes to being hired. All of a sudden, bring in this guy. He's a proven winner. And that's where you get paid. Like, to me, it's if you look at your career as a ladder, on which rung do you really try to monetize the most? And if I'm Rod Brind'Amour, I say to myself here, okay, I know that my owner doesn't want to pay me what I'm worth on the open market, but there is value in me staying here because this can lead to a bigger paycheck somewhere down the road.
I don't believe that in this case. I think this is simply a person who does not want to leave that area of the league. I had a really long conversation with another coach about this yesterday, and we were talking about the responsibility versus personal happiness question. Mm-hmm. And this coach and I were talking about Brind'Amour is happy. And what's the old line? Don't bleep with happy.
Yeah.
And if a person's situation says, I want to be here and I don't want to leave here, nobody has a right to complain about that. Like, I support Brind'Amour's decision. If this gets done, and I think most people believe it's going to get done, but still, I believe his staff is fighting for their contracts too. I think that's we've talked about this. It's the last conversation here. Nobody has a right to tell somebody else they should do something that isn't best for their family or might make them unhappy. I understand the whole position about, well, you know, like, you've got to do what's best. You know, Mike Babcock, when he got his big deal from Toronto, he was very proud of the fact that he blew the lid off the salaries. The way I look at it is, and we talked about this a bit last night on Hockey Night, there's a book I'm looking at right now. It's in my library. It's called The Bald Truth. It's written by David Falk, who represented a lot of top NBA players like Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing. And what he would do is, if he saw a deal that a team used against him that was sub-market, or that someone else had signed that he felt was submarket, he would flip the conversation and say, that's their situation. That's not your situation. And if he felt he had leverage with a player, that would be his answer. Now, sometimes you don't have leverage. Sometimes, you know, they're going to say, all right, well, he makes this, so you make this, and you might not have a choice, or you might be forced into making a decision if they're not willing to go past a certain point. But, you know, the overall Brind'Amour thing, my position is, if he's happy, he's happy, and nothing can be done about that. He's happy. It's the decision he wants to make for his family. We have to respect that. And other coaches are simply going to have to say, if I was being compared to that, I wouldn't like it, but I would simply have to find a different way to negotiate. And there's been times in my career where I've had the hammer and I've used it. And there have been times in my career where I've wanted the hammer and haven't had it. And I haven't gotten everything I wanted. So I understand it. I appreciate it. But I just don't think at the end of the, like, it's someone's life. They have to make the choices that are best for their family, especially now.
So back to Columbus then. What do you think of the John Tortorella era in Columbus? Like, if you can isolate a couple of, like, for me, the first intermission of the first game against Tampa in the playoffs, like, that is the crowning achievement for John Tortorella.
He keeps Bobrovsky in and they rebound.
Yeah. All, and, you know, the and the speech in the locker, like, all of it. Like, that to me is, like, if you're going to pinpoint one moment where, like, okay, what is John Tortorella in Columbus? That was it. Between the first and second period of game one against Tampa in that sweep series. That to me is John Tortorella in Columbus. Who's John Tortorella in Columbus to you?
Well, if you heard the crowd last night,
oh yeah,
they really thought highly of him. So this is the lesson I would learn about John Tortorella if I was the next team to hire him. John Tortorella coached in Columbus for how many years? It was one too many. So put it this way. I think there are a lot of players who liked being coached by John Tortorella more than we realize. Many more than we realize. I think there's a lot more players who liked being coached by him than we recognize. Because a lot of us see the crazy stuff and we give that weight. Like, for example, so Aaron Portsline of The Athletic, who I think is, you know, one of the best reporters in the league. No, you know, nobody knows their market better than he does. He did a piece last week asking people to talk anonymously about the Blue Jackets. And when he tweeted about it the night before, I think everyone thought it was going to be a hit piece, right? Mm-hmm. Like, just, you're given anonymity, and you know when people are given anonymity, they are going to use it to their advantage. They're going to clobber people. It didn't. I thought it was really balanced and I thought it was really fair. And for the most part, the players were complimentary of Tortorella. But there was one quote, and I'm saying it from memory. I don't have it right in front of me, but basically said, you know, you've got to fire the coach, right? And the person was even still fair to Tortorella, but basically said it was time. I think if a year ago, if Tortorella leaves Columbus, his legacy is secure there. It was 1 year too long. And, like, my question is, do you leave a place better than when you found it? And my answer on Tortorella would be yes, he did. But there was enough that happened this year that I bet if everybody there could go back, including him, they would probably say, we wish we would have done it 1 year ago. Now, 1 year ago, I think they were considering it. And I do think Tortorella was tired. But what I heard happen was there were several very key players on that team that asked the organization and Tortorella to come back for a year.
Hmm.
And I just think that they agreed to do it. And I think if everybody, Tortorella, the team, even some of the players would go back, they would probably say, you know what? We probably were 1 year too long. So if I'm hiring Tortorella, I recognize that A, I've got a good team, B, I've got veterans, and C, I know that I'm doing this with a certain window. That's the way I look at it.
So one of the questions that everyone's wondering now that, you know, John Tortorella has to indicate, look, there's still coaching life in me, is what's next for John Tortorella? Like, where are the possible landing spots? I know a sexy story is the Rangers. Mm-hmm. Another one would be a full circle spot, which would be the Buffalo Sabres. What do you think, Freach?
Again, I think it's going to depend on what some of these teams' goals are. Like, you know, what are the Sabres' goals next year? We know what the Rangers' goals are. I do think that if they make the change, and I think that's a decision that Chris Drury is going to listen to what his players have to say and kind of make that call from there. I think there would be interest if there was a change in New York in Tortorella. I don't know if he would become the front runner, but I do think they would have some interest. See, one of the things I'm wondering about is, you know, Tortorella's last job, he went into Columbus when they started a season 0-8, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, what happens if he doesn't have a job at the beginning of next year and someone goes to him early in the season? Like, I don't know, but I could see that.
Hmm.
It goes back to what we're talking about. It's going to be an interesting offseason because I think a lot of these hirings are going to come down to what these teams are looking for. Are they rebuilding? Are they trying to win? And also, how much are they willing to spend? And then there's the Seattle equation in all this. They want an experienced coach. I'll tell you something, too. I don't know what to make of the whole Travis Green situation in Vancouver either. The Canucks are, they're an interesting team. Like, they wait and they wait and they wait and they wait and they say, yeah, we want to get things done. And they get some things done. They don't get other things done. It's, I don't know how to handicap what's going on there right now.
So what I've always been led to believe, based on the people that I've talked to who I believe, it sounded early on this season that Travis Green had either a number or a range in his mind of what he was worth and didn't want to come off that.
I think there's truth to that.
Is that still the case, though? I don't know the answer. I ask legit. Is that still the case?
I think there's a number he wants. I don't know what that number is. I got to think it's probably over 2, but I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think the Canucks want to come in lower than that. And I don't think there's been a lot of conversation there this year. I think they've, you know, the best I can tell is like the team's kind of said at times, what do you think about this number? And he said, I kind of like this number. And they're really, but there really hasn't been a lot of negotiation. I find it really hard to read what's going to happen there.
What I wonder about here is, and we sort of talked about this with Rod Brind'Amour, who, you know, comes in, you know, when this thing finally ever gets done, he's coming in under market value.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that does to, I wonder what that does to the slotting of all other coaches whose contracts expire.
What it becomes is it becomes a, who's got the leverage.
The reason I bring up slotting, because that's the normal course of business in a quote unquote normal season. This coach makes this much, therefore I should make that much. And everybody sort of agrees on those amounts. And you have a rough ballpark of what coaches are making, how they're all slotted and how they're compensated. This is the freak year. And this is a freak year that sort of winks at a few years coming up right now where traditionally owners of teams may have said, okay, well, fine, financially that makes sense based on precedent. But right now it's a totally new universe. Right now, it's completely different. So I wonder how many teams are just saying, don't tell me about the old model. We're starting a new one now.
I think you're totally right about that.
How much reset then is Columbus going to go through now with a new head coach coming in?
So this is my question, and I'm sure we'll hear the answer when Jarmo Kekäläinen meets with the media. What do they see themselves as? Are they rebuilding or are they contending? Like, he's going after a center. But is he keeping Patrick Laine or is he flipping him?
To me, the first thing that has to be asked if you're Jarmo Kekäläinen, even before maybe you start looking to go out and get a centerman or two centermen, really, when it comes down to it, is what's happening with Seth Jones?
Well, yeah, you're right. I should have said that first. That is the biggest question.
That's the whopper, because everything changes when Jarmo is allowed to re-sign Seth Jones and extend him. If he says no, then everything changes in Columbus. Honestly, maybe I'm too naive here. Maybe I'm missing something. But isn't Columbus's direction predicated on will Seth Jones re-sign or not? And if he will re-sign, then this is not a rebuild. But if he says, no, I'm not interested in an extension, I'm going to test the market when my deal is up in 1 year, then all of a sudden, all bets are off.
Well, I think it depends on what you think you can get for him too, right?
Sure. But you don't think you can get a first-line center for Seth Jones?
My answer would be yes, but just centers are really hard to find, right?
Sure. And
they're hard to get.
Yep. No doubt. And so are defensemen like Seth Jones too. Like,
I agree with that. Like, you're not like, I'm a Seth Jones stan. Like, it's not like you're arguing. You have to really argue with me here. Mm-hmm. You know, the only thing that, you know, I think will make people nervous about Jones is there's a big contract that comes at the end of this, right? You're a year away from a contract. So, you know, what do you think you need to sign Seth Jones for probably determines a lot of that question. But I agree with you. If A, what does Jones think? And B, if the answer is no, what can you get for him? And I think you're probably in the same boat as with Zach Werenski. Now, Werenski is 2 years away from UFA as opposed to one, but you can extend him after this season.
So the question becomes then, Tortorella exits, who goes in?
So I think it depends on the direction. What is the direction of the team? Because Arizona, I think, for example, is different. There have already been some reports that Arizona, for example, also the mutual parting with Rick Tocchet, they're going young. Well, who have some of the names that have been out there already? Rocky Thompson, Nate Lehman, Lane Lambert, I think would be in that conversation. You know, one name that makes a lot of sense to me there, I just don't know if he'd be interested, is Mike Van Rijn. Because Mike Van Rijn coached, was an assistant in Arizona, and then he went to St. Louis when Bill Armstrong was there. Mm-hmm. So that makes a lot of sense. I just don't know if Van Rijn would want that particular job. Like, I don't know. So Arizona, to me, what that says is they know what they're doing here, and that is rebuilding a bit. I'm not sure yet what Columbus' vision is.
Let's get to Arizona. So the parting of the ways after four seasons, Rick Tocchet, Arizona Coyotes. You know the name that I'm curious about, just because it was an interesting hiring at the time. So I wonder what the pitch was. And that's Corey Stillman. So they got Corey Stillman away from the Sudbury Wolves of the OHL, where he was coaching his son. I would have to figure that Scott Walker would have been part of that pitch to get him into Arizona. And I'm not saying that the pitch is something along the lines of, hey, you know what? The minute the organization's done with Rick Tocchet, this could be a good place for you, and you may end up as a head coach of this team. But I wonder, like, when you talk about this team wanting to go younger and wanting someone that relates to younger hockey players, Stillman's already there. The organization knows him. He's 47 years old. I don't know, Frege. That's a name that pops right out.
It's funny you mention this because I think you told me this. And I've asked around and the answer I've heard is not yet. Like, I think he will get his chance someday. I've heard Corey Stillman will be an NHL coach someday. But someone who was handicapping the situation for me said he doesn't think that's going to be the case yet. But they think he will be an NHL head coach someday.
Curious what, quote unquote, happened here with Rick Tocchet and the Arizona Coyotes. Do you have a sense of why he is no longer with the organization?
I just don't think that was a marriage that was ever going to last, right? So Rick Tocchet was hired by the previous administration. There's a new administration that came in, Bill Armstrong. Tocchet was still under contract. Just in texting around the organization today after the announcement was made, one of the words I got was awkward, just to describe it all year. You could kind of tell that, you know, they weren't on the same page. They tried to keep it away from the players, but, you know, people knew, people know. They knew that Tocchet wasn't coming back, that they didn't see completely eye to eye on some things. And I think everybody kind of knew it was going to come to this at the end of the year. I don't think this comes as a huge shock to anyone.
Any idea what's next for Rick Tocchet? Worked as a head coach, worked as an assistant.
Well, I think he's going to have some options. You know, Anthony Stewart was tweeting, of course, that he played with Ron Francis in Pittsburgh. You know, where does Jim Rutherford show up? And what could that mean for Rick Tocchet? You know, one of the things that Tocchet has a great reputation with, and, you know, it's not a surprise when you hear about what his relationship is with Phil Kessel, is that he's one of the best around at handling players who are not easy to reach.
Hmm.
That he is fantastic at dealing with players like that. So I wonder, is there a team that thinks they have a situation like that, a player they need to get to. That's one where Tocchet really knows what to do.
You mentioned Phil Kessel there. Let me get a quick thought from you on Phil Kessel. I was texting with a lawyer friend of mine who works for one of the hockey organizations. And he said, look at Phil Kessel, 20 goals again, shortened season. And he made the point that in a league that so strongly values offensive production, this guy produces each and every season. Throw in the 900 consecutive games as well. And there's Phil Kessel. I don't know that I've ever asked you this. What are your thoughts on Phil Kessel?
One more year under contract, right?
Yep.
Signing bonus, $5 million. So what's the actual cash? 1.8? They're going to see if anyone wants to go for that.
You know the storyline that I was trying to get going around trade deadline as a talking point. Kessel back to the Bruins.
Oh, that's right. I remember that. Oh my God. That was crazy town.
I thought you would enjoy that.
But that's the thing. Like Arizona needs picks and prospects, right?
Oh, that's what they're after. Give me first rounders. Give me prospects. Give me kids. Yes.
Like, I wonder if that's what they do.
Well, look around the NHL universe and look at your goal-starved teams. And look what Phil Kessel does. He scores easy goals with that shot. And he produces every year. Pencil him in. 25, 30 goals.
1 year of Kessel just had, a 20-goal season.
One of the other questions we have about the Arizona Coyotes is, are they going to hire an assistant general manager?
That's a good question.
Dun, dun, da, da. Okay, on that, we'll welcome you to the program, everybody, now that our little monologue is over. 31 Thoughts, the podcast, The Coach's Edition, featuring Kirk Muller, presented by the GMC Sierra AT4. Welcome to it.
Takes a look. McDavid coming from the point, moving up. His pass hit a skate, and Nurse is able to recover and keep it alive for Edmonton. McDavid, Draisaitl shoots, scores! Draisaitl scores! But the torch is being passed on from one drink to the next. The century mark in just 53 games for Connor McDavid!
Great call by Harner Ryan Singh. Connor McDavid, 100 points. Listen, I thought in our Sportsnet predictions, Elliot, that I was being a little over the top saying, Art Ross Trophy is going to be 95 points. Yeah, not so fast. Connor McDavid, 100. We're going to get to Connor here in a couple of moments, but I want to pick up on the coach's conversation from a couple of moments ago. Where is Gerard Gallant in all of this? It seems as if you could make the argument for all these positions that become available that Gerard Gallant may just be a fit.
Oh, yeah. I have to say, it's actually surprising to me that this guy who took Vegas to the Stanley Cup in his first season and their first season doesn't have a head coaching job yet.
Yep.
It's actually a big surprise to me. I got to think he's going to be in here. No question about that for me. He's going to be in. I just believe it, and I think it's going to happen. Can I pick where yet? No, I want to see where everything ends up. But the one thing that is true is he's going to the World Championships this week sometime. So I could see some teams jumping in and interviewing him before he goes away.
You know, maybe the obvious story is, well, he did it with Vegas. Could he do it with Seattle? You'll wonder if there would be interest there from Ron Francis. I have no idea. I know it's a really easy story. All I know is if I'm any team in the NHL, Elliot, and I have a coaching vacancy to fill, he's going to be one of my phone calls. He's going to be one of my conversations. Easy.
I think you just heard what I said. I completely agree with you.
That's a layup. Okay, Mark Bergevin contract extension. What do you hear? What do you know?
So I heard that they've been talking about it, and Bergevin wouldn't talk. Jeff Molson wouldn't talk. Everybody's really careful. You know, it's interesting that one of the people I spoke to about it, just kind of trying to gather some information, he said to me that you're working on this at a very tricky time for them, right? You know, they still haven't clinched as we do this on Sunday afternoon. They hadn't clinched their playoff berth yet. Now, they're going to get in, barring the miracle of all miracles, but it was done. Like, I think Jeff Molson believes in Mark Bergevin. I do. I think he believes in his vision. But, you know, it still hasn't been put to bed by the time that we do this podcast. I think they've talked about an extension. I think they've talked about what it could look like. But, you know, someone else said to me, what if the way this ends this season, you know, Bergevin says he's tired or he's had enough or anything like that. So I think what they're doing is they're kind of talking about how they're feeling, where things are. How does Bergevin feel? How does Molson feel? But I do think there have been negotiations on an extension. And the only thing with me is, I mean, you know how careful I try to be, Jeff. I don't want to say anything until we know for sure, but I do think they've explored all options. Bergevin's last extension was done, I think, 19 months before his contract was up. Mm-hmm. I don't believe the Canadians want to go into next year without some clarity of his future. If you go into Montreal with your GM in the last year of his deal, I mean, look how it's gone for, you know, Carolina in the last week or two. It's going to be a billion times that for Montreal. So I think they're searching for clarity, and I think they're working at it. But I do think there have been negotiations on an extension and also conversations on what it could mean if we don't get to one.
Connor McDavid. Let's fly through a couple of these topics here. Connor McDavid hits 100 points.
Yeah.
I don't know at what point it became obvious that he was going to hit the century mark, but it felt like it was really easy for him. You know, like it felt like in his mind, there was A, never a doubt he was going to win the Art Ross, and B, never a doubt he's going to hit the century mark. As much as he, in every post-game press conference, wants to, you know, defer to all of his teammates and talk about their accomplishments and not his, did you not get the sense that there was almost a singular focus with McDavid this season that he wanted to remind the NHL who the real boss was and who the best player was?
I totally believe that. I think the best are motivated that way. You know, the one reason I think some people get kind of turned away from that theory, Jeff? Do you remember earlier this year when Matthews had the 4-point game on the Saturday night and then McDavid went out and had 5 points against Calgary in the back end of the doubleheader?
Yeah.
So we're all talking on the show about how there's no doubt that McDavid watched that and he's like, I'm going to do better. And so a reporter heard that. I don't remember who the reporter was, but they asked McDavid that and he's like, why would you ask that question? So I think it, it takes people away from that, right? You hear McDavid say that, and you're thinking, I can't really go with that narrative because he shot it down. But I do think that whether they admit it publicly or not, they're driven to be the best. They are demanding to be the best.
Elliot, you know why I don't put much stock in that response to the reporter about the Matthews question? Here's this question. Who is the last person that Connor McDavid wants to talk about?
Jeff Merrick?
And Connor McDavid himself. The two are neck and neck. But like, he goes out of his way not to bring attention onto himself other than how he plays and where he cannot help but bring attention to himself. It's almost like he's that classic, just watch what I do and then let me talk about something else. Let me talk about my teammates. Let me talk about something that I feel is greater than myself at the risk of diminishing everything I've just done. But listen, I've just done it in front of all of your eyes. So that should be enough. Don't ask me to talk about myself. That's my talking. That's Connor. That's Connor.
Could be. I was surprised by the by that answer, though. It was pretty blunt. It was pretty pointed. But yeah, I mean, that could be the reason. Like, I'm not going to argue with you. Certainly could be the answer. But I've said it many times. I think he's been totally shafted on MVP voting most of the last few years. Mm-hmm. I think that he set such an impossible standard for himself that, like, even this year, I don't want to weigh into this because I think this is the stupidest debate ever. Like, what's Twitter? It's full of stupid debates. There's this one now about it doesn't matter because the North is soft. I mean, come on. Like, every division has crappy teams. Come on.
But the thing that people are pointing to
I would actually say the North has less crappy teams than a few other divisions do.
But as people have pointed out, to defend the North, you know, all of a sudden Sam Bennett looks like a superstar after he leaves Calgary and Barabanov in San Jose's point a game and couldn't make the Maple Leafs lineup.
You can go through the entire league with this kind of stuff, right? It's just stupid.
I'll tell you what, though. That's what makes the playoffs, you know, after the first two rounds, intriguing for anyone that follows a team in the North Division. Because, Elliot, as you all know, in the back of everyone's mind, and maybe it is just Canadian insecurity in general, mm-hmm. don't you get the feeling that every marketplace, there is a place in everybody's brain where they wonder, are we good enough? They look at Vegas, they look at Carolina, they look at Colorado, go right down the list, Washington, Pittsburgh wins a division, the Islanders are a tough out, and say to themselves, I don't know if we're good enough.
You know, I got to tell you this. I guarantee there's a ton of people there. They're just, I always laugh when people do this. They're marking tweets now and screenshotting them for the third round of the playoffs.
Of course.
They're like, I hope I get a chance to embarrass this person in 6 weeks because the North Division winner wins their semifinal or the other way around. Yeah. There's somebody down there, some crazy hockey fan in Vegas now, it's probably Gary Lawless, who is saving tweets about how good the North Division is so he can put them all out after Vegas beats the Canadian winner of the third round. I mean, it's so funny. It really is funny.
All I know is every fan base in Canada has that niggling little feeling that maybe they're not as good as the teams in the U.S.
I think you should do a five-part special on radio this week.
The insecurity of the Canadian teams, of every single Canadian market?
Yes.
Listen, I just think that's a Canadian thing in general. Listen, that's more of a cultural conversation.
We worry too much what other people think about us. We really do.
We've always been that way. It's always how we've measured ourselves. Right. But the thing is, you know what, though? One of the best comments I ever heard about this was from Mike Myers. Mike Myers was on the Dave Letterman show, and Letterman said, how come it seems per capita there are more comedians and comedic critics that come out of Canada than the United States? And Myers, in a really, really smart answer, said, well, here's the difference. Americans watch TV. Canadians watch American TV. And I thought that was a really smart response. There's an ironic layer that exists between what Canadians consume and the actual event itself, whereas Americans are just consuming what they're involved in, that there's a critical awareness about U.S. culture that the United States doesn't have because they're it. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked. I want to ask you a couple of things really quickly on some things that happened this season. Namely, are three Philadelphia Flyers going to win the Pittsburgh Penguins the Stanley Cup? Ron Hextall, Brian Burke, who played for the Maine Mariners, and Jeff Carter. What a story this has been, Elliot. I know Nashville was a great story to get to the playoffs, but man, the Pittsburgh Penguins win the division.
Like I told you, the 30 for 30, if the Penguins win the Stanley Cup, about how Brian Burke saved everything, it's going to be something else.
This really is a remarkable achievement for Pittsburgh.
I still have another week to really sort out my ballot, but you know, right now my Hart Trophy ballot is McDavid 1, Matthews 2, Crosby 3.
Mm-hmm.
Carter is unbelievable. You know what Carter reminds me of? And I've learned this myself. It's the danger of comfort. He was comfortable in LA. Didn't want to leave. I totally understand why. His family very happy there. Now goes to Pittsburgh. sometimes we just need to get jolted out of our system.
And if you're going to get jolted out of your system, I mean, Pittsburgh and being in the same room as Sidney Crosby, where there is a work rate established by the captain that you're embarrassed not to follow. Like, that's just like, how many times have you talked to someone that went through the Pittsburgh experience and said, man, like, I was embarrassed not to work as hard as Sidney Crosby. I was never going to be as good as him, but that guy worked harder than all of us, and it made everyone embarrassed who didn't try to work the same. Like, that's why you can make the argument that as far as Hart Trophy candidates, Crosby should always be in the conversation because of what he sets in Pittsburgh. Ask everybody who's been through Pittsburgh. They all say the same thing.
I'm good with that.
The first round series I'm perhaps looking most forward to...
Florida-Tampa.
...is Florida-Tampa.
You know, I got to say this. If I didn't live in Canada, I probably wouldn't feel this way. But as a Canadian, I think it has to be Montreal-Toronto. Just because we haven't seen this for a generation.
There are two series. One is the historic pull at your heartstrings. You know, it's been too long since these two have met in the playoffs, Montreal-Toronto. But there's the other, which is these two teams who share a state have never played against each other in the playoffs, and it is long overdue, and that's Florida-Tampa.
Whoever plays Minnesota is going to be a good series, too.
I agree. And all I know is the best games I've seen this season are Minnesota-Vegas. Mm-hmm. Those have been the best games this season, period. Do you have a quick thought on Florida-Tampa?
Oh, my goodness. That's going to be something else.
Let's just hope that it goes seven games. Because a game seven between these two teams, we've all been waiting. How many times have we been waiting for Tampa and Florida to be good at the same time? Forever, right? Mm-hmm. Here we are. And here we are. Quick break. We're going to come back and talk to Kirk Muller. Wonder if he fills one of these coaching vacancies. I will talk to Kirk Muller on 31 Thoughts, the podcast, in moments. We are pleased to be joined by Kirk Muller, who, considering his background both in coaching and in playing as well, Elliot, really doesn't need much of an introduction on a podcast like this. So we'll start off with Kirk. Hello, how are you? What has Kirk Muller been doing lately?
Well, first of all, hi, guys. I've actually been down here in California for the big reason that I just became a grandfather for the fourth time and came down to visit my daughter, who's married to Brad Malone, involved with Bakersfield Condors. So
nice.
I'm watching a lot of American Hockey League games and enjoying my new granddaughter.
What is the feeling of becoming a grandfather? And by the way, you probably look like the youngest grandfather in North America.
I've been nonstop. I have a three-year-old down here as well. So I haven't had time to shave, so I don't look like Elliot did in the playoffs, but no, you know what? I'll tell you what, the NHL is a grind and it's a busy schedule, but keeping up to a three-year-old and a newborn, I think it beats it, but it's been amazing. It's been special that I'm able to be here and it's been fun. It's been fun.
I hope you and Stacy spoil those grandkids rotten. That's what you're there for.
Yep.
Yeah, you know what? We just absolutely came in and took over the grandkids and all the good habits that they've been working on, especially everyone who has a three-year-old knows we've kind of just spoiled them. So we're going to tiptoe out of here and head back to Canada soon, and they're going to have to break all the bad habits.
You know, Kirk, you've had some time to sit back and think. The Canadians made a coaching change back in February. And just, you know, in the couple months since, what do you look back about? What do you think about? And how much do you watch them right now?
When you're out here, that's the one thing you get to see the Eastern games and then catch the Western games because of the three-hour mm-hmm. time change. So, you know, you get that benefit of seeing, you know, more games usually. But I've caught Brad's games, a lot of the American Hockey League games, because they're still active out here playing in Bakersfield. So, you know, it's good, you know, a good chance to sit back and watch games and not have to not be involved with one team. So you can be neutral mind on everything. But no, I've caught Montreal playing and, you know, they ran into some injuries to some key guys that have, you know, obviously, you know, like any team, you know, it's tough when you lose key guys like Gallagher, and, you know, Pauly Byron's a big key to the team as far as a core guy, the glue guy and all that. And with obviously the carry. So, you know, they've gone through the challenges of a schedule, a tough schedule with injuries and all that. But they're a really good group of guys, and they got a lot of character there. They got a lot of good additions, and I wish them well. I know what it's like to be in a pressure market like that, and how hard it is. And this is a tough year in the world for COVID and everything, and a challenging year. And, you know, I hope those guys do well because they're good people.
You know, you mentioned that marketplace, and, you know, Jonathan Drouin has taken leave from the team right now. And we've talked a lot about the pressures on hockey players in the big markets, and have made the point previous that Montreal might just be top of that list. Give us a sense of what that market is like and the nature of the pressure that's on, well, really everybody in the Montreal Canadiens organization.
Well, it's what makes it a special place, and the fans are passionate. The media, as we know, is a lot of pressure, passionate. You know, the whole province, the whole Montreal fans within the country, the North America, the world, you know, and the history, there's high expectations. But that's what you really, I really enjoyed, you know, coaching there and playing there and feeling honored to be a part of that organization. But it's like when I got traded there as a player, and Guy Carbonneau said to me right off the start, one of the first things he said, he goes, I got to tell you something. I know you came from New Jersey and, you know, the market down there, but just understand that if you're the goat today, don't worry about it, because tomorrow somebody else will be, or it's a news story. So if you can understand that it's a day-to-day event, what happens today is old news tomorrow. And always understand that if you're playing well, you're probably not playing as well as you're being told you are. And if you're playing poorly, you're probably not be playing as poorly as you are. So the key is longevity and being even keel and riding the waves. And if you could do that in those markets like Toronto and Montreal and New York and all that, I think, you know, you understand it once you're there that you're not going to be great all the time. You're not going to be, you know, poor all the time, but just ride the waves and be consistent and just stay the course. And if you have that confidence of doing that, then, you know, you see people do well in those markets because they thrive on the other part of it, which is the pressure and the excitement and the demands and everything. And I tell you, as a player, you know, I love playing there because of those reasons.
It's so funny that Jamie Baker always said that when Baker ended up in Toronto, Wendell Clark told him, listen, you're never as good as they say you are, and you're never as bad as they say you are. I've always remembered that. Like, Kirk, you and Wendell must, you know, go read the same books because it's the exact same advice.
Well, I know Wendell doesn't read, so that's not it's, don't tell him I said that, but no, it's true. You know, Wendell's been involved at the least as a player, obviously his great career there, and then he came back, and you know, he understands it. You know, the pressure, and it all comes down to the great thing about it is both cities have fabulous, passionate fans, and they want to win. And if you're going to be that passionate and you want to win, there comes consequences and demands. But I'll tell you what, I always say this, when I was in Montreal playing and you come off a long road trip from out west and you're exhausted, and the hardest game to play is that first game back home. And, you know, it's because of the travel, the jet lag, the 3-hour time change. And you get back and the fans are like, wow, we have not seen you in 2 weeks. You know, here's my ticket. I'm coming to the game. I want to see you guys dominate. You're back home. You should be fired up. And you go out and you're like, I got nothing. You know, it's the worst feeling in the world. And I remember Montreal, you know, that first period, and we would come out west and we would have a great record of maybe 5 wins and 7 games and feel good and go back and you got nothing. And right off the hop, those fans would be letting you know what, you know, you'd hear a few boos and all that. And you're like, okay, I better pick up my game. So, you know, it's amazing how the mind is powerful and it gets you jump started, you know, when you got nothing in the tank. And that's pure mental, pure fan pressure, which makes it awesome.
I am curious about, you mentioned earlier on the playoffs, and I'll tell you what, that was, you know, last year in the bubble, very challenging time for everybody. We understand that. And you're behind the bench and you're able to sweep the Pittsburgh Penguins. And this is a season where come trade deadline time, Montreal was all out and they find themselves in the bubble in the postseason. And you did something that was pretty special. I guess this is a long-winded way, Kirk, of me asking, how did you do that?
It's really interesting when you look at it. You know, COVID hits. We're sitting in Montreal, and we play Buffalo that night. Looking back at it, that game never happened. If Buffalo beats us that night, they would advance and went to the bubble, and we would not have. The game doesn't happen. We end up being the team that gets in last. So here we are, a non-playoff team. Circumstances happen. We get a chance to go into Toronto and compete in the playoffs. You know, basically what happened is, you know, we got together. We prepared a lot of meetings because it was a short camp. And I give the players credit. And we did our meetings. We did our prep. We walked in. And I thought we were, you know, a well-prepared team that was ready to go. And we upset a good hockey team and surprised a lot of people. And when that happens, you know, it's quickly, we see every year, once you get into the playoffs, anything can happen. And momentum kicks in, confidence kicks in, timing kicks in. And then unfortunately, you know, Claude got sick. But the nice thing was within a day, we were well aware that he had recovered and he was in good shape and he was going to be fine. So it gave us a chance to go, we can now just focus on round two with the team that was Philadelphia, that was the hottest team in the league going into the bubbles. And again, the guys performed well, they played hard, and we almost did an upset in round two.
The guy who I think really took a huge step was Suzuki.
Yeah, you know what? And I think that was the thing that happened that was great, was it gave Suzuki and KK, some of these young guys, some an opportunity to play and gain confidence. And hey, listen, it was a unique situation. We're in Toronto. All focus is on the playoffs in two places, Edmonton and Toronto. And these guys shine under the pressure. So he's a very smart player. He's a very methodical player. That was his opportunity to say, hey, you know, listen, I was a pretty darn good player in junior and had great success, and I think I could do that at this level as well. So, you know, it showed that, you know, what a good NHL player this kid is and what he's going to be. He's going to get better and better.
This may be unfair, and I almost hate doing this to players, but is there anyone you can compare Nick Suzuki to in the NHL? He's a huge fan of Patrice Bergeron. He trains in Stratford with Joey Hischen and loves working out with Ryan O'Reilly. Is there anyone you could compare him to?
Well, I thought Bergeron is a good example in a way, because Suzuki, two things. He takes a lot of pride in his game offensively, and he takes a lot of pride in the game without the puck. And I think that gives him the ability to be a two-way player. And both those players, they don't play with a mean streak, but they have a little bit of edge to them that they're competitors, and you're not going to get them off their game. They're both going to be focused on the agenda that's at hand, and you know, whether it's you know, trying to shut down another elite player, or they got to score a big goal. And he's a mature kid for his age, and he knows how to play the game, and he's smart. So when you compete and you're smart, you're just going to get better and better in any sport or anything you do, and that's what Suzuki has the potential of being.
What are your thoughts on Kotkaniemi?
KK is a kid that's in that progress of getting better and better. You know, he came over and he's got the body that he's still filling out. And, you know, people forget the NHL is tough. And, you know, you're playing against men quickly. And, you know, I know that he's playing against men overseas before he came over and everything. But I tell you, it takes a couple years to get your feet wet and understand who your opponents, who you're playing. he had to learn the North American game a little bit, you know, as well. Mm-hmm. So that takes a little bit of time, just that alone. And so if you see the progress in him, he's a kid that's starting to get that more man strength. You know, his skating's improved, his strength's improved. He's got a heck of a shot. You know, he sees the ice well. He's another kid that's very determined and, you know, wants to get better, wants to be a part of a winning team. And I think it's taken him. He's still one of the youngest players in the NHL. And, you know, you put that all together, you got a kid that's got a lot of potential. And again, I say this all the time. If you're willing to want to get better, you probably will get better. And those two guys have that type of attitude.
We asked Bob Hartley this question. We just had him on the podcast not too long ago, and we asked him about some of his favorite coaches, not necessarily mentors, but coaches that he's admired. A couple of things. One, when did it dawn on you that coaching might be something you'd be interested in, and who are the coaches, Kirk, that had the most or the biggest effect on you all your way through the NHL?
Well, I'll start with some coaches, yeah, definitely that I had as a player. Pat Burns was amazing. When I got to Montreal, he was the one coach that I'd say he had that ability to grab you as a team. And although I hated his practices because there was so much of grinding one-on-one and defensive grinding, they weren't sexy, fancy drills that you did with Burnsy, but you know what? He had the ability to say, listen, our game is really simple and we're probably not going to surprise anybody with any little tricks or anything like when I was playing in Montreal, but this is who we are. This is what you're going to expect. And we're going to play our game or we're going to beat you at our game. And he always made you have that feeling like you're going to win every single game. And you did it because of he expected you to play the team game and do your role at the best that you're capable of doing. And that was it. That was simple. Everyone's like, oh, Burnsy was a real tough guy, which he was, but he was so fair. And he's like, well, what are you surprised about? You didn't do your job tonight, so I didn't use you. Or, hey, you played well, but I expect you to play well. And guess what? You got to do it again tomorrow night because if you want to win, you got to be consistent. And I love Burnsy because you knew exactly where you stood with Burnsy. Jock Demers happened to come in after Burns, even as in Montreal, and we won a cup with him. Totally different personality, totally different coach. But, you know, you look at Jock, and here's a guy that, you know, won coaches of the year. He won a Stanley Cup. And his strength was he never pretended like he had all the answers and he was the best coach in the league. He was a great players coach. He wanted feedback from his players. He wanted you to go into his room and say, listen, we practiced too hard. I'm not sure about the travel. What about this? You know, here's some suggestions. And you know what? He took it and he would use it. And he'd say, here's the deal, guys. I'll take your – I remember Carbo and Patrick and I would walk in and throw suggestions. He goes, hey, listen, I'll shorten practice. I'll do this. But guess what? It's up to you guys to make sure we get the results and we win. So – that was his ability, and he gave you the freedom to play your game, but within the, you know, the team concept. So great characters of two different guys there. And I finished my career with Hitch. And the great thing about Hitch was he was fun, and I had him at the end of my career as a veteran, and we had a veteran team in Dallas. We went to the finals together, and, you know, it was fun because I don't know if I was young, if he would have got under my skin and been tough. But as a veteran guy, he would challenge you and push us and push us and push us. And, you know, we could handle it. But you know what? He had great records. And he was probably the coach that I played for that was so well prepared. Mm-hmm. There was never a thing that you didn't know about your opponent. You walk in the morning, everything's organized, everything's prepared. Everything's thought out. He's up early in the morning. He's at the rink early. And so for a player to walk in and be prepared to play a hockey game, I think Hitch was one of the best coaches for me as a player in that circumstances.
Hitchcock has coached recently. Do you think Pat Burns could have coached today's player?
I think Burnsy could. because from the outside, and you see Bernsey, and if you're a fan, you know, like, you know, his success in Jersey and Toronto and Montreal and, you know, good teams and everything, you know, he looked like that hardcore guy, you know, and he was. And I just described him as a player, and, you know, guys, Dougie Gilmore and Wendell and those guys, and they, I'm in Toronto, they loved him and everything. But you know what? When you're playing for him, there's that soft spot that he really related to his players. And I think that's huge today. Like, you can be honest with the players today and they respect that and they love that. But you got to build relationships. And Bernsey, he wasn't the cozy fuzzy guy, but he certainly, mm-hmm. he certainly knew his players. And then, you know, it's a different generation, but then, you know, he'd go out and have a beer with the guys and be comfortable to spend an afternoon with them, and they're comfortable with him. So they knew that he had their back and they had his back. And I think the same thing applies today. It's all about relationships with your players and getting them to know that they trust you, that you're there to make them better and to get them to win hockey games.
Okay, I'm going to throw something at you that you probably weren't expecting to talk about today, but, and I can I can already hear Elliot rolling his eyes.
Oh, juniors?
No,
oh
no, I'm not going to. Yeah, what happened with Guelph and the Team Canada? No, I'm not going to ask about all that stuff, but I am going to ask you, because I'm forever fascinated, and I always maintain that 1987 was the greatest year for hockey, period.
Oh, actually, this is a good question.
Okay.
Canada Cup was great. Stanley Cup final was great. Easter epic. Like, 87 was fantastic. And the one thing about 87 that I really loved was Rendezvous.
Oh.
A two-game series. It replaced the All-Star game at the Colisée in Quebec City. NHL stars win one. Soviet Union wins one. And the hockey was fantastic. And there you were.
From an international site, the ceremonial face-off. We are just about ready for the face-off. Game one of Rendezvous 87. The NHL All-Stars against the Soviet Union. Coming up.
What are your memories of Rendezvous?
Freezing cold weekend. Okay, two of the best hockey games I think I ever played in my whole career. You look at the talent of the two teams, the Russians at their peak, the fact that they were a team that always played together. So they were, you know, in tune. These guys had played together for forever. You know, Tretiak, Kazatonov.
KLM line, whole KLM line's in them.
The KLM line, you know, those six guys right there. Then for me, I was shocked and so honored to be a part of that team. Because of I had so much respect for so many peers that weren't on it. And here I come to Quebec and I'm playing with Wayne and Messier, you know, and I'm sitting here like, wow, what a hockey team. And I remember like going and playing in that first game and we won.
Yep.
And I was like, this is unbelievable. That game, I honestly playing in Olympics and All-Star games and Stanley Cup finals and everything, I have to say it was the first game where I sat there and being a part of a game and going, I'm in awe. Like, I'm in awe of the pace and the skill level of this hockey game. And yet I'm like, I got to play in this game. I'm like, but you know, just watching the skill and the way the game was played and everything, it was so exciting. And the fact that it came back a split.
Yep.
And, I don't know if you can duplicate that or if it'll work again today, but best two games I think I've ever been involved with.
There was still a bit of a mystery at that time, the Russian players.
Yes.
Was there a guy that you remember playing against that maybe you didn't know and you said, holy, like I remember watching Valery Kamensky and saying, oh my God, this guy's really good. Was there anyone like that for you?
I honestly was going to say Kamensky. I was like, you know, there's so much attention. And I'd gone to, as you mentioned, the Olympics. And when the Russians were on fire and to see them over there. And, you know, we were young and we weren't, you know, obviously the top Canadian team. But then when we bring the NHL best and we play against these guys and we're like, okay, now let's see it, you know. And so I was aware of like Krutov and Makarov and Leonov and these guys from playing against them before. And first of all, talking about them, I never played against players that were so powerful and so hard to defend against in the corners. Mm. I've never seen players like that. And their leg strength and core strength, like everyone talks about their skill, but you can't imagine going to corners and trying to play against these guys, their strength. And then you have the skill level on top of that. But Kamensky was the younger guy, and his size and his skill level and with the puck and his shooting ability and everything, I was like, I think he was the guy that really caught people off guard.
Let me ask you about one specific player in the 80s as well, as we sort of detour to 80s hockey here. Outside of Wayne Gretzky, no one put up more points in the 80s than Peter Stastny. Playing with the Quebec Nordiques, he would have played against them. And then he goes to New Jersey as well. Do you have any memories of Peter Stastny?
Yeah. You know, we never really had so-called like star players in Jersey at the time, like a real Hall of Fame kind of guy. And so we all started off young there, you know, John McClain, Joe Cirelli, Pat Verbeek, Brendan Shanahan, myself. And we kind of, you know, started off as you know, an organization at the bottom. We had to earn our respect to get better. And over a few years, you know, Lou came in and put his mark in the organization. And we, you know, we're gaining respect. But, you know, we're missing sort of those key type names. And Lou brought in Peter. And right away, Peter and I and Claude Lemieux played together. And we were aligned. And I thought, wow, I'm playing with obviously a future Hall of Famer. And I've never battled so hard with two line mates. I think we battled and fought harder against each other in a good way than we did against our opponents. Peter was a perfectionist and he was a heck of a player, but every shift, you know, if you made a play and if you didn't make the right play or find him, and I say this in a very respectful way because that's what made him so good. You knew that when you got to the bench, you know, he'd be like, Kirk, I was open. You got to give that puck to me. And I'm like, I said to him, I said, Peter, see that number 9 on the back of my jersey? It's not 99. So you're not going to get the puck the amount of times you think you are. So I had Claude on the other side going, hey, I was open. I go, listen, you two, like, you know what? I'm in a non-winning situation here. But, you know what? Hey, listen, I say that in a fun way that they're both competitors and there's a fun line to play with.
So you mentioned number 9 there. This is something I'm glad you got us here because I've always wanted to ask you this one. Your first year with New Jersey, you were number 27 because Don Lever's wearing number 9.
Yeah.
Was there ever a conversation about, hey, Don, do you think I could wear number 9? That ever happened?
No, I had a lot of respect for Don. And I was like, I wore 9, you know, pretty much my whole life.
Yeah.
And you know, he was a veteran guy. And, you know, we started in Jersey with a lot of veteran guys like Donnie Lever, Mel Bridgman, and Tim Higgins, and Rich Preston, and Davey Lewis, and, you know, all these guys that were these mentors to us. I was like, hey, I'm just happy to be in the NHL. So I wore 27 in the Olympics and they gave me that number. But my greatest 9 story is when I got traded to Montreal and Serge Savard called me and said, hey, I just traded you to Montreal. And I didn't know Serge at all. And I was, you know, just excited and everything. And he said, so, you know, you're going to come up and, you know, you're going to, you know, meet Eddie, the equipment guy, he'll get you set up, all the formality of when you get traded. And I don't even know why I said it. I didn't know Serge, and I just said it for a joke. And I said, is there any chance I could get 9? And he said to me, Kirk, do you know the history of the Montreal Canadiens? And I said, of course I do. I said, I'm just kidding. But a couple years later, I go to the All-Star game, and now they gave me 11 in Montreal, which is just what they gave me. I had no choice. I was like, fine, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to wear it. And I played in the All-Star game, and it goes by seniority. And so they said, listen, you're a Montreal Canadian. The game's in Montreal, but listen, Marc Messier has a seniority. We're going to give him 11, and you're going to wear 9. We figured you'd like that. I said, yeah, that's awesome, sure. So what happens to me now, I go up after the game, and who's waiting for me? True story, Rocket Richard. And Rocket calls me over, and he says, hey, Kirk, you have a minute? And I said, yeah. And he says, you a Hab? And I said, yeah. He says, you wear 9 today? And I said, yeah. And he says, don't make it a habit. And I walked over to Steve Shutt and I said, I just told what Rocket told me. And I said, do you think he was kidding? And he said, no. Nope. No, he was not. So that was my 9 story with the Rocket.
I wanted to ask you about coaching. You want to get back in?
Yeah. You know what? I feel blessed that, you know, an honor that be involved in the NHL. And I've been lucky to play in it and coach in it. And, you know, what makes it special is the people involved and the competition at such a pro level and the competitiveness. And yes, you know what? I enjoyed the coaching. I enjoyed, you know, when I was in the bubble, I got a taste of the head coaching again from the days I was in Carolina. I think it's just being a part of a group and wanting to win and leading that group is a lot of fun.
Now, I understand that, you know, you've been obviously a head coach, you've been an associate head coach, you've been an assistant coach. You want to be a head coach. Like, you want that second opportunity at that job, correct?
Yeah, you know what? It's the right time. I had an opportunity to be the head coach in Milwaukee and Carolina. And, you know, is where I feel I had a great opportunity from Jimmy Rutherford and Ronnie Francis to start there and starting a head coach with Nashville's organization. And, you know, from then, you know, I learned some things and that's where I got my experience. But, you know, since then, I said I want to learn from some veteran coaches. And, you know, I went to St. Louis and worked with Hitch and saw how he operated. You know, we went to the third round and had that great opportunity to see on a daily basis how, I said earlier, how well he's prepared and the work that he puts in to have a team prepared to play every day, every practice and that. And then, you know, I worked with some more veteran coaches, fortunately. You know, Michel Therrien, when I went back to Montreal, learned from his type of theories and the way he sees the game. And, you know, with Claude Julien just previously. And then went over to the Worlds with AV. And when you look at a lot of these veteran coaches, you know, I had firsthand experience of working with them, seeing how they operate, taking a lot of great things from everybody. And then, you know, having that chance to coach in the bubble and being behind the bench and being the head guy for a series, you know, the confidence was there. And I feel like this is the right time for me to go after it and be a head coach.
Okay, here's my last question to you, Kirk. Is there one guy from your career that you battled against that all these years later, you're still not friendly with?
Oh, good question. I will say there's not a player that I could run into today and I could say, I don't want to see that guy. You know what? There's like Dale Hunter that, man, when I played against him, he was, we all know he played. And, you know, when I was in the more of the Patrick division back in the Jersey and Washington days, and, you know, I think we still have a record for the most penalty minutes in a series, like Washington, New Jersey. It was vicious. And, you know, I had to go head to head with him, and then he goes to Quebec and everything. But I got a lot of respect for him. Like, I guys like Scott Stevens back then, and, you know, these guys. I mean, if you play with your head down, you're in trouble. They're not giving you a mercy rule, you know. Honestly, there's not a guy that I'm across the street. I don't even want to see him. I think I played in a time where the respect was there. It was tough. It was good hockey. It was high scoring. But I think because of that respect, I don't think I have that for anybody.
Okay, last one for me. I want to get your thoughts on coaching 3-on-3. Because when 3-on-3 started, we all loved it because it was, well, we thought, uncoachable. And it was up and down and odd man rushes and coaches would be pulling their hair out on the bench. Coaches now very much have their hooks in the 3-on-3. Kirk, from a coach's point of view, what do you do with 3-on-3?
Yeah, good question. Well, you know what? You look at 3-on-3, a few things that come into play. You know what? Do you want to get your best face-off guy out to win the first face-off? So you start off with possession because you know that if you do the percentage of goals scored on 3-on-3, a high percentage of them are scored on the rush. Guys missing the net in line changes. Bad line changes are a big part of 3-on-3, which are correctable. It's interesting. 5-on-5 hockey, what do you tell your guys? Go to the net, get the rebound, drive to the net. But, you know, in 3-on-3 hockey, you think, listen, you want to move the puck around to get that shot because, you know, not too often, it's not too obviously, it's always from a rebound and all that. So you got one guy shooting, another guy going to the net. If he misses it, guess what? It's a 2-on-1 the other way.
Yep.
So you got to be real careful on your shot selection on 3-on-3, missing the net, goalie pops it out, easy rebound, away you go. And so there are scenarios right there. And then I think a big part of it is a responsibility with coaches is to say, hey, listen, before a game, our goalie's awesome at shootouts. Their guy perhaps isn't. Our record on shootouts is strong or poor. Our opponents are strong or poor. So maybe we should sit back a little bit and we're a better team tonight percentage-wise to maybe win the game on our shootouts. We got three great shooters. We got a great goalie. Let's play back. Let's play a little bit more of a zone. Or you're the opposite. You know, you're type of coach. You know, you look at it and you go, we're really struggling on our shootouts, our confidence. Guys aren't scoring. You know what? Let's go three forwards. Let's go for it. Let's go for the home run. Let's go try to win it. I think all those intangibles, I think, are ways that, you know, you kind of approach a 3-on-3 hockey.
Okay, let me ask you this final wrap up then. It looks to me sometimes like teams are just holding on to the puck, waiting for either a bad switch on the other side or a bad line change. And that's when they pounce. How accurate is that?
Well, exactly what I was saying. You know, it's if you're aware of, and again, it's, you know, in the zone, you know, if you get that long change, and if you're a smart hockey player, you're sitting on the bench, you're watching how long the other team's guys are on the ice. So that you know if you get out there and they're struggling and you outchange them and now you're fresh, you're in the offensive zone, and you know that as soon as it's popped out, they're racing for that change. And if you could counter quick, I mean, that, to me, that's a smart hockey player. You're like, so, you know, that's why, you know, you pay attention on the bench. You know, you watch the game, so you watch who can't get off. And so when you go on the ice, are you going against three fresh guys? Are you going against a D that's exhausted, he's got that long change, he can't get off.
Yeah.
So you bite, you know, you sell it a little bit, you bring it back in the neutral zone, you hope some guy bites on it, goes for the change, and then you go for it, you know. So there's a lot of smart hockey players in the NHL, and I would say there's a lot of little things that would happen that for 3-on-3 hockey.
That's a great answer. Okay, Grandpa, we spent enough time with you today. Thanks. Thanks so much, Kirk, for stopping by today. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, great chatting with you guys. Great chat with you. We'll all enjoy the playoffs coming up.
And there it is, our conversation with Kirk Muller, someone too good to be out of the game for much longer. I wonder if one of those vacancies ends up filled by Kirk Muller. We thank him for joining us on this week's edition of 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Taking us out today, a three-piece band from Vernon, British Columbia, who now call Vancouver home. Singer Aidan Andrews and twin brother rhythm section Carson and Nolan Bassett making up the band Desorme. We're carving out a unique space in modern alternative music. With their latest single, here's Desorme with The Trend on 31 Thoughts, the podcast.
Keep your eyes shut, keep your head down, waiting for ages. It's painless. All this noise talking about nameless. Oh, 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 yeah, my brain exploding under orange streetlights. Talking slowly, you can hear me cry. Brain exploding under orange streetlights. Crack my voice so you can hear me cry. Nothing gonna change the tides and move the weather. No one's gonna die, but